Unmarked by Dan Abnett. Read by Gareth Armstrong. No man ever steps in the same river twice, for it's not the same river, and it's not the same man. Attributed to the ancient Heraclitus. Mark, unknown. He is known as Ol. That is what he gives as his name. Back on Calth, some people in the community used to call him Pious, because in a largely godless age, he still believed in the old faith. There are five people travelling with Ol. They're starting to believe in things too, the sights they have seen. Gods, demons, heavens, hells, all the apocalyptic fire and lightning of the old-time faith. But real, after all. Ol Person, the Ol is short for Elenius, has been his name for a long time. Ol Person has been his name for longer than any of his travelling companions can even imagine. They move up country, the six of them, climbing scarps and stony ridges that seem to rise above clouds, not because the clouds are low, but because the ridges are impossibly high. There are no hills like that on Calth. They are not on Calth, not anymore. They all know it. They have been walking for about 2 days. It's hard to know exactly how long. There is no night and no day. Zybes has an old-style wrist cron, and its hands are spinning backwards all the while. Rain and Crank have army-issue timepieces, steel dials on rubberized black straps. The timepieces have been reading blank since they all stepped through the cut. Blank. No time mark. No time at all. No nothing. Just glowing runes. Dashes, flashing on and off. Trumpeters boom in the valley below under the cloud. They have only seen them from a distance. Crank dubbed them trumpeters when the travellers first heard the booming calls. Whatever the trumpeters really are, they're probably too old to have a human name. "Keep going," says Ol Person. "Push on." The day Calth died, the day the 17th Legion turned traitor and ritually murdered the planet Calth, Ol Person took a knife and cut a hole in the universe. He cut a hole as though he were making a slit in the side of a tent, and he led the five of them through it. And in so doing, he saved them. The alternative was to stay behind on Calth to face a death more painful, more grisly, more fundamentally cruel than it was possible to imagine. The 17th had turned on the Imperium. They had massacred a world, murdered their brothers, slaughtered billions of innocents, and spat venom in the face of the God Emperor. To help them commit these crimes, the 17th had brought with them... Well, what? What had they brought with them? Demon is the only appropriate human word, but it is scarcely adequate. There are non-human names for the things that the 17th brought to Calth, but none of the travelling companions want to know what those names are. All five of them, two Imperial Army troopers, a labourer, a girl, and a servitor, would prefer to forget most of the things they already know rather than know any more. They witnessed things on Calth that almost made the sight of Ol Person cutting a slit in the universe with a ragged Athame dagger seem normal. He saved them. He took them with him to escape the planet's death. They did not bother to ask where he was going or how he knew to go about making the journey. They trusted him. Even before he took out the ragged Athame dagger and, right in front of their eyes, cut a hole in time and space, they suspected that Ol Person was far more than just a grizzled old Imperial Army veteran turned farmer. The five companions are Trooper Bail Rain and his friend Trooper Dogent Crank, both of the numinous 61st, both raw and inexperienced. Hebet Zybes, who had done piecework on Ol's farm during the harvest. Cat, the young woman who had done likewise and who had been so traumatized by the 17th's attack she could barely speak. And Ol's old heavy-duty agricultural servitor, Graft, who could only ever call him Trooper Person. "Trooper Person, what are we now, Trooper Person?" asks Graft. They are toiling up the dry scree scarp, skittering loose stones back down into the cloud behind them. Graft's augmetic voice is like a hollow, badly tuned vox. Are we survivors, Trooper Person? All shakes his head. No, Graft, he replies. We're pilgrims. The trumpeters are louder. They're getting closer. A sun rises, a local star. It is hot blue in an onyx sky. It is not Kalth's sun, not the Ushkul II, the sacrifice star that the 17th sorcerers made from Kalth's sun. It is another sun, in another system, in another part of the everywhere. The six of them have walked for 2 unmarked days, and they are on the other side of the galaxy. The journey is only just beginning. Ol gets out his notebook, his pendulum, and his compass. He keeps the last two in an old low-leaf tin. The compass looks as though it's made of silver and designed to resemble a human skull. Neither of these things is strictly true. He hinges the silvery cranium open and peers at the dial. He has a watchmaker's loop to help him see the tiny inscriptions. The pendulum looks like it's made of jet, but it is not. It is warm in his hand. An old friend gave them both to him to help him find his way. The notebook is half filled with tight handwriting. It is all his, but it has changed over the years because there have been so many years. There is a chart in the back. He folds it out. It is a 22,000-year-old copy of a chart that was already 22,000 years old when the copy was made. These distances of time seem vast and impossibly precise, but all can be precise. He was there when the copy was made. He made it. On Terra. The chart shows a windrose of cardinal points. Ol hangs the pendulum over the compass, records the metrical interaction of both instruments in his notebook, and consults the chart. Africus, he announces.
What?
Asks Ibes. We need to change direction, says Ol. Mountain winds coil like snakes around the ridges and scarps. There is an intermittent rain in the wind, and it tastes like blood.
The rain tastes of blood, Bale says, a finger to his lips.
So don't taste it then, says Ol.
He makes a good point, Crank says.
He laughs to show that his spirits are still up. It is like him calling the trumpeters, trumpeters. He's just trying to keep them cheerful. It is not really working. Bale keeps a steady hold of his gun. That reassures him. It reassures him more than his friend Crank's banter. The gun is solid, the last solid thing in the world, whichever world it is. The gun is an Imperial Army issue LAS rifle with a wooden stock and furniture and blue metal fittings. It is clean and brand new. Bale has a musette bag of clips to fit it. It is not the shoddy hand-me-down weapon he was issued with at the founding. Crank has a similar spotless weapon. So does Zybes, though his is the cut-down bullpup carbine. Cat has a short-frame auto-pistol. They all got their weapons from the same place. It was just after they'd stepped through and left Kalth, left that night-shrouded beach on Kalth where the air rang with the distant whoops and howls of the things they call, for sanity's sake, demons. It was the first place Ol took them to via another knife slash in the world. It was lowland, a fen. There had been a battle there, a terrible running skirmish through the reedy dikes and waterlogged channels. There were bodies all around, 2 or 3 days dead, turning black and bloating in the heat. The uniforms they were stretching and straining were those of an Imperial Army unit that neither Bale nor Crank knew had been serving on Kalth. This isn't Kalth, Ol told them. This is another where, another when. Don't ask me, I don't recognize it. He bent down, fished a set of dog tags out from under a swollen throat.
Mohindas 11th, he said.
He sighed.
Mohindas 11th, God, wiped out to a man by the Nefertil on Diurnus in the 6th year of the Great Crusade.
That was more than 2 centuries ago, said Bale.
These bodies are fresh, Crank exclaimed.
He looked at the inflated meat sack at his feet and shrugged.
Fresh-ish, a day old,
to, maybe. They are, said All, rising.
But, said Crank.
As I said All, another where, another when. They looked at him. I don't make this stuff up, he said, shrugging. I just endure it like you. I'll check the compass. We might have to change direction again.
Why do you trust that compass thing? Asked Zibes.
Why wouldn't I? Asked All. It's God's own compass.
Cat was looking at the bodies littering the ground, the brooks, the ditches. We should stop here, she said. We should bury them all. They deserve respect.
It was only the second or third thing they had ever heard her say, and they were already beginning to realize that Cat spoke rarely, but what she said was honest.
We should, All said, nodding. Heaven knows you're right, but this is another when and another war. Trust me, girl, there's a terrible darkness coming, and it will leave so many dead, so very, very many. There won't be enough left alive to bury them all, even if they dig day and night. Only thing we can do is keep going and fight for the living. We don't have time to care about the dead. Sorry, that's the way it is.
Cat started to cry a little, but she nodded. Just as they'd come to see the honesty in her infrequent pronouncements, she had come to appreciate the honesty in him. All stooped again, took a mag clip out of the corpse's bandolier, and checked the fit to his old, old service weapon.
Gun up, he said, filling his bag with recharges.
They hesitated.
Come on, he said. These poor souls don't need guns where they're going. We need them more.
Besides, these are new patterns. Crusade issue, brand new, just 2 or 3 years old, not like the refurb crap they handed out at Numinous.
We're lucky. Where we are right now, these are the best and newest weapons we could get our hands on. So, get your hands on them.
They helped themselves. Bale had to get the pistol for Cat and persuade her it was all right to touch it. That it was okay to touch it. Okay was an odd word, but All Person used it, and they'd learned that it meant all right. All stood to one side and smelled the wind. He thought about what he just told them.
We're lucky. Where we are right now, these are the best and newest weapons we could get our hands on.
Very damn lucky, he said softly to the wind. Who made sure we'd wind up here? The trumpeter's sound, booming up from the invisible valleys below, they all know that there are better places to be.
Can't you make another hole? Asks Zibes, wiping rain off his face.
A hole? All asks, frowning.
A cut with that knife of yours. This isn't a good fix to be in, is it? Don't pretend it is.
All Person shrugs.
It's not as bad a fix as Calf.
There is something else he was going to say, but he bites it off. The trumpeters sound again, ominous, like cosmic punctuation.
I can't just cut where I like, All says, making a motion with his hand as if the athame is in his grip. It doesn't work like that. I have to be in the right place and make the right cut. Places touch each other in the oddest ways. I cut through the skin of one, and we're into another.
They're all looking at him.
It's complicated. It's not even an exact science. Someone taught me the rudiments a long time ago.
Who?
Asks Zibes.
How long ago?
Asks Cat, which is a better question.
It doesn't matter, replies All, not answering either of them.
The point is, it's not an exact science, and the someone who taught me the rudiments also told me it was a terrible thing ever to have to do it, that it was something no one would choose to do unless there was no other choice.
Because lives depended on it? Asks Bale.
All shakes his head.
No, he says. Much more important than that.
He starts walking again, crunching up the scarp in the dying light. He knows he has said too much and that he has discouraged them. The veteran soldier in him, in fact there are several veteran soldiers in him, knows better than that. In a fix like this, a decent commander does not spit on morale. He cannot take back what he's already said, but he could cheer them by saying more. Cheer them, or distract them.
The winds, he says. That's the key to it. That's the key to any voyage, as any seafarer will tell you. You follow the winds. Follow where they blow.
He glances back at them. Not these winds, he says, raising a palm to feel the cold mountain air run between his fingers. I don't mean how the air moves. I mean the primordial winds, the winds of the Empyrean, the winds that keep the ever-ocean tossing and thrashing. He starts walking again. I use the Romani names, he says, because they're the ones I was taught. Right now, we're following Africus, following where that wind blows. It's a southwester. That's why the Romani called it Africus. But the Greekans, they knew it as Lips, and the Franks, they called it Vuecestroni. He looks back at them again. See? He asks. Crank raises his hand, like a child in a scolum class. Yes? Asks Ol. My question would be, what are Romanis? Says Crank. Ol sighs. He wonders if they have time for him to answer that, and he doubts it, because they do not have any time for anything at all. Never mind, he says. So, we follow this wind, this Acrophus, says Bale Rain.
Africus,
Cat corrects. Yeah, that, says Bale. We follow this wind to
where?
To the place where we make the next cut. To the next place where the skin between worlds is thin. Providing the trumpeters don't catch us first, asks Crank. He laughs, a piping ha-ha-ha that the breeze lifts away. Pretty much, says Ol. They sleep under a fold of rock near the summit of a ridge. Ol sits watch. He wants to push on, but he can tell how tired they are. They need food. They need water that does not taste like blood. They need sleep. They need a good, clean cut that will take them away from the trumpeters. Ol does not think of them as trumpeters. Last time he met anything like them, creatures of a similar breed, it was multiple lifespans ago in the Cyclades, and they were called sirens. It is just another word, no better than trumpeters, no worse. The only thing Ol knew then, and Jason agreed at the time, was that the creatures did not come from the Cyclades. They did not belong there, no more than the trumpeters belong here. They were from an elsewhere that had nothing to do with this world, or any other. They were like a damp or a rot that had leaked through a wall from outside. The noises they made, they would drive a man mad if he had to listen to them for long. They would make him forget himself. Make him forget. Ol wakes up. He does not know how long he's been out. An hour? Just a few minutes. The others are still dead to the world. It is as cold as a tomb's vault under the rock. It is dark, and there is no sound except the pattering of the rain. He had been dreaming. The remnants of the dream are still hooked in his mind, like splinters in skin. Hard, fresh sunlight on moving water, light dappling, the sea green like glass. The ship is a proud ship, and will be remembered for so long that it becomes a myth. There is an eye painted on the prow, a common mark in those days. All the galley warships in the Middle Sea had them. There is laughter from the deck. Ol feels the hot sun on his bare, tanned back. He can hear Orpheus playing the sort of melody that would keep out the noises of the sirens. It is a good life in that dream, that memory. They were better days, a better adventure than the one he has embarked upon. This new, unmarked journey, knifing a route from world to world, it will not be remembered. It will not pass into myth like that long sail to Colchis and back. This journey will not even be remembered long enough to be forgotten. It might be more important, though. It might be more important than any adventure he has undertaken in his life. His lives. Ol realizes he was thinking of it as his last journey, his last adventure. He realizes he is expecting it to be the final exploit of his life, the closing act, one last brave outing in the twilight of his time. Except by any means of measurement, he is supposed to live forever, unless some agency stops his life. So why is he thinking so fatalistically? The last splinters of the dream are still there, the eye on the prow of the boat, staring and hard, beautiful and coal-edged, like Medea's enchanting eyes. But terrible, too. A single eye. These days that mark means another thing. He saw it in the last dream he had, the dream where John came to him and showed him terror on fire. That cursed eye is why this will be his last adventure. Damn you, John, he whispers. He gets up, rubbing his hands, his arms. They have to get moving, push on. They've been down too long. They're getting too cold, too damp, losing too much core temperature. And the trumpeters have gone quiet. That is not a good sign. Get up, he says, trying to rouse them. His hands are numb. It is so dark. Get up, come on, he cries. We have to push on. No one is stirring except Graft, who activates at the sound of All's voice. Trooper Person! Wake them all up. We have to move, All says. Something skitters on the stones out in the darkness. All's hands are numb, but he takes up his rifle. Get up! He cries. Still no one stirs. He aims in the air and fires a shot. Wake up! He says. Now they have. They are all cold and wet and scared, woken from unfriendly dreams to an even unfriendlier reality. Cat is crying, but it is the cold, not the stress. Crank is tearful too, because he has had enough of it all, and it is nasty. All urges them up the slope over the back of the ridge. There are things on the scarp behind them. Trumpeters, All guesses. Even trumpeters know that it is sometimes most productive to stay quiet. The damn sirens knew that too. The ridge is a black hump ahead, suggesting better light beyond. Dawn, maybe. They crest it and see a paleness, a pale blueness in the sky behind. They go over the ridge. All has Bale lead the way and takes the tail spot himself, swinging back to watch for things pursuing them. Parts of the darkness move, but not so much he can make a target. God help us, he says. He does not doubt God's plan, because he is a man of faith, but sometimes he thinks God has put them up to all of this. All the holy books, all of them from every creed he has ever studied, they're full of stories about souls being made to suffer and endure just so they can attain salvation. This is his time to be Job, his time to be Sisyphus, his time to be Prometheus, to be Odin, to be Osiris. This is his time to endure. What is more, it is not even his own salvation he is suffering for. All thinks he should not have to be tested any more, not after the life he has led. They go down the slope and onto the back of the next scarp. It is much lighter. A pre-dawn glow makes the sky ahead of them translucent like smoked glass. All has a sudden, bright feeling that they're close to where they need to be. It is like seeing a single star low in the sky on a lightless night and realizing there is something to navigate by. He glances back. There are trumpeters on the ridge behind them. They are huge bipeds, swollen and heavy, with long counterbalanced tails held up, swishing the air behind them. Their throats rise into heads like floral blooms or pitcher plants, like fleshy mechanisms that part and extend and broaden. They begin to make the noises again at the dawn sky. The volume is incredible. The strange wet flanges and crests of the heads move and bunch to modulate the expelled notes. Push on! All yells at the others. The noises make them falter, the noises and the sight of the things along the ridge. All knows that look. Soon they will not be able to think. Where is Orpheus when he's needed? Some beeswax, even. He plants the stock of his old rifle against his shoulder and fires at the trumpeters. He sees them whinny and flinch as his shots spark against their leathery, feathered flanks. He does not think he can kill them. He just wants to make some noise. Bale, Crank, and Zybes turn and start shooting too, following All's lead. Soon, four las weapons are cracking away up the ridge at the trumpeters. Zybes cannot hit anything, not even horrors that big, but Bale and Crank, who've never seen actual service, are fresh out of founding basic and have been gun-schooled. Their shots are clean, decent, neat. It is not the hits that All wants anyway, it is the noise. The squeal and crack of four infantry weapons up close could drown out, or at least disrupt, the effect of the trumpeting. Make a noise, like Orpheus did. They keep shooting. After a few minutes, some of the trumpeters turn, belly heavy, and waddle out of sight behind the ridge, stung too many times by the annoying las shots to want to stay. The others follow. Like cattle, All thinks. Like cattle turning away as a herd, a collective. The hooting dies away behind the ridge. He cannot shake the thought of them as cattle. Cattle suggests grazers, herbivores, and that suggests a darker possibility. It suggests something the trumpeting is supposed to keep at bay. It suggests a predator. All cuts a hole, and they step through. It is hot on the far side, dry heat like an oven, a bright sky that looks like it's been painted blue and then sandblasted. They are on a road, a dry and dusty track. They walk for about 10 minutes, long enough for all to realize he knows where they are. He sees the first of the dead tanks, a burned-out T-62, and knows they will see a lot more if they keep walking. In the space of one long, hot day, right at the burned stump of M2, the regional despot lost a mechanized brigade and an armored brigade, 150 tanks and hard-shell vehicles.
"Why here?" he asks out loud.
"Who are you asking?" replies Zybes.
"What are you asking?" asks Cat.
Tank shells and metal wrecks line the road and the wadi beyond. The air smells of smoke and burned oil. All wants answers, but there is no one to ask. There is nothing but dry bones. Zybes calls out. They go to him. There is a trailer on its side in the ditch. There are plastic jerry cans of water, warm in the sun. Food packs, bedrolls. Whatever was towing the trailer was hit so hard, only lumps of it remain. This is why. They are dry already and warmed from the sun. They load up with the supplies they can carry, loading the water cans onto graft. This is why.
"Good luck we came here," says Crank.
All is looking at something.
"Someone's luck," he replies, not turning from what he's seen.
He is staring at the remains of another battle tank. The treads are gone and the wheel fairings are bent. The hull's blackened and scarred, and the turret has been half ripped off like a can that has had its lid gouged away. There is a mark on the side, just under the 18th mechanized emblem. It could just be a curious little shrapnel scratch because it is damned near indecipherable, but it was scored into the metal after the hull burned, showing bare steel through the caking of soot. It is a word. A name, maybe, but not a human one. Makar. What does that name signify? And who thought to inscribe it there? They stay for a few hours in the sun, moving along the dead road between the corpses of war machines. All checks his map and his compass and discerns the next place.
"Not far this time," he says.
"You were here, weren't you?"
Cat asks him. All wonders whether he should answer, and then he nods.
"Where is this?"
"They call it 73 Easting," he says. "The greatest armoured battle of its time, they reckoned."
"Which time was that?"
she asks. He shrugs.
"Which side were you on?"
she asks.
"Does it matter?" he replies.
"You must have been on the side of the winners," she decides.
"Why?"
"Because you're alive, and all these machines are dead."
"Okay,"
he nods. "Okay" means something different now. He looks at her, squinting in the desert light.
"Just so you know, my being alive doesn't have much to do with the outcome of any battle. I've lived through things on all sides one time or another. My life isn't predicated on victory. I'm just fond of it, and I'll chase after it when I can."
"What is your life predicated on, then?"
she asks.
"Just being alive," he says. "I don't seem to be able to lose the habit, and it's hard to take from me."
He looks back at her. Her eyes are dark-lined and big. They remind him of someone. Medea, of course, that crazy witch, so beautiful and full of so very many difficult questions, just like this girl.
"It's hard to take from me, but not impossible," he says.
"You're some kind of immortal," she says.
"Some kind, I suppose. We refer to ourselves as perpetuals."
"We?"
she asks.
"There are a small number of us, always have been."
"Should you be telling me this?"
she asks.
"Should I?"
Arl asks himself. "I've never really spoken of it to anyone. not anyone who wasn't like me. But I'm standing in my own distant past in a place that no longer exists, and I've got a long way to go before I can rest. A very long way. I'm telling the secrets of ancient terror to a girl who won't understand them, and who will never be found or known, and certainly will never be believed. Under this blue sky, in this desert wind, looking into eyes that should have belonged to a witch from Colchis, or at least been drawn on the prow of a Cyclades warship, what secrets am I really giving away?
It's okay, he tells her. I think I can trust you.
What kind are you? She asks.
What?
What kind of immortal?
Oh, Ol says. He has never been required to answer that before. The ordinary kind, he says.
When he cuts the hole this time, just before dusk, the desert wind gets up at 73 easting, and the dry bones in the dead hulls start to rattle and fidget. The dead are sensing something, and it is not Ol and his companions. Ol knows that the dead do not feel much. They are only sensitive to a few things. Things that do not have human names. They leave through the hole to the sound of dry joints grating, and ribs fluttering, and teeth grinding. The unease of the dead. They sleep the next night in a wood in the rain. They make a shelter using canvas rolls they brought from the trailer and eat some ration packs. Artillery thumps and drums in the distance. There is a war going on over the hill. Ol knows he is being played with. It is a pine wood, a familiar scent. He's not sure, but he is pretty convinced he knows this place too. Is this benevolent guidance, or someone leading him into a trap? Most likely the same person either way. Damn you, John. Ol gets up early and leaves them sleeping. If he remembers it right, there is the end of an old communication trench not 300 paces from the line of the wood. He can smell the river, which means that Verdun is to the west. The trench is right where he remembered it, right where he and the other men dug it. It is abandoned, slightly overgrown. A shift in shelling caused a tactical displacement, and this part of the line got emptied out. Small blue weed flowers nod. Grass sprouts between tumbled sandbags. Bulwark armour plates are rusting. The trench floor decking is sodden and unmaintained. He can smell coffee grounds, and nettles, and latrines. The bright brass of spent shell cases litter the ditch and the sandbag line. Ol follows the jink in the zigzag trench under a low cover top. He walks slowly, warily, carrying a rifle that will not be made for almost another 30,000 years. There is the down step into the officer's dugout. He remembers it all as if it was yesterday. In the dugout, there is a small desk made from a fruit box, a coffee pot, a stove, a dirty enamel mug. There is a dark stain on the back wall. Someone left in a hurry. Someone who was hurt. On the desk, there is a logbook. He opens it. It is a repurposed civilian diary, locally manufactured. The paper is cream, the numbers and the ruled lines all printed in the faintest blue. The diary was intended for a year, 1916, a date so antique that he can barely make sense of it. The first half is filled in with neat handwriting, ink pen, well schooled. He wonders if it is one of his own hands, though he remembers the place so well that he would think he would know. It is not his. There is only one word written in the diary, over and over again. Makar.
I can't stay long, he says.
Ol turns, bringing the rifle up. John is in the trench outside the dugout entrance, leaning against the back wall. He's wearing a body glove and dusty overalls.
Damn you, says Ol, letting his aim slacken, feeling stupid for being surprised. You got it, I see, John says, nodding at the athame wrapped up and hooked in Ol's belt. It's really that important?
It really is, says John.
You should be doing this, not me, says Ol.
Oh, come on, says John. You could hardly stay on Kalth. It was a friendly warning to help you get out of there.
Besides, I've got my hands full. I've got a job of my own to do. Yeah? Don't ask, and I won't tell.
I thought this errand you had me running was the really important one, asks Ol.
It is. It honestly is. But my job is important too, and frankly, you are in the right place. I'm on cabal business, Ol. They sign my paychecks, you know that.
That's not a phrase I've heard in a long time, says Ol.
He almost smiles. The cabal watches what I do. I can't be everywhere.
So I'm not on cabal business, asks Ol.
No, you're not. I shouldn't even be talking to you. For the first time in a long time, Ol sees a look in his old friend's eyes. It is a look that says he is trying to do the right thing, even though the universe is out to make sure he does not. It is the first time that Ol Person has pitied John Grammaticus in a long, long while.
Look, Ol, says John, I'm going to try to be there when you arrive. I'm going to try my damnedest.
But
what?
I've got this presentiment, Ol. A dark gloom.
That's the way your mind works, John.
No, Ol, this isn't a psyker thing. It's like just knowing something in your bones. I think I may be running out of road at long last. I think this may be my last adventure.
They'll just bring you back, says Ol. The cabal will just bring you back, like they always do.
He says it fast, almost like an accusation. He says it to cover what he's thinking.
Why do we both feel the same thing? Why do we both feel like this will be the last adventure for us? The universe is in trouble when perpetuals feel mortal.
I thought you said this would be pretty bad for everyone, Ol says.
On Kalth, you told me that. You said it was make or break.
John nods.
It is. I meant it.
I mean, personally speaking, I've got things to do, and I've got a choice to make, Ol, and I don't think I like either of the alternatives. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I wish I could do this instead of you and not put this responsibility on your shoulders, but I can't. I want you to know I appreciate what you're doing, Ol. I honestly think you're a better man for this job than I am.
Ol does not reply.
I'll try to be there when you arrive, John says. But if I'm not, if I'm late, I think you'll know what to do.
What have you got me into, John?
You'll be fine.
John, you've been guiding me this far. The weapons, the food, the locations, all very apt and ironic. The typical Grammaticus flair for the theatrical.
John shrugs, snorts.
You're trying to smuggle me along, aren't you? Ol asks. Take me on an indirect route. Take me the long way around so I'll be harder to track and find.
Ol steps out of the dugout into the early sunlight to stand face to face with John.
That's why it had to be me, isn't it? He asks. God, I see that now. I'm not a psyker like you. When I move through the warp, I'm not as visible. You'd show up like a beacon. That's why I'm doing this dirty work for you.
John does not answer.
What's Makar, John?
You shouldn't have brought the others with you, John replies.
Why?
They won't make it.
They certainly wouldn't have made it where they were, replies Ol.
It would have been quicker, kinder.
They'll make it if I make it.
John nods. It is not reassuring.
What's Makar, John?
Come on.
What does it mean? Is it a name?
John looks towards the river.
Time's out of joint for us all. Nothing's in the right order. Makar is its name.
Not a human name?
No.
I don't know if it's called Makar yet, or if it will be called it one day. The warp doesn't work in step with time as we perceive it.
He looks at all with sad eyes. The foe won't let you just walk away from Kalth, not with that dagger. It sent something after you. That something is called Makar. It helps that you're taking a roundabout route, Ol, and it really helps you're not Psychana and glow in the dark like I do.
Yes, that's why you're doing this instead of me.
Yes, okay, I admit it.
But even so it's coming. Makar is coming. You watch your back. The only real help I can give you is to warn you to keep away from it for long enough.
What does that mean?
It means it's needed for another task, too, so it can't keep looking for you forever. Keep going, keep down, stay out of sight, and it will eventually have to give up and turn back. Why? It has a destiny of its own. Just watch your back, all.
Give me more help than that, John, damn it! I deserve more than that. How do I fight this thing?
I can't. I'm sorry, says John. He looks genuinely apologetic.
I've got my hands full. I can't. You're not even here, are you? Asks all, realizing. Where are you really?
The wrong side of Ultramar, says John. All sighs.
So if you're not here, I'm not either, am I?
He wakes up in the shelter in the Pinewood just before dawn. Rain taps on the canvas. The others are asleep. He knows there's no point heading down to the trench. John will not be there, and all has already learned everything the trench can tell him. It's time to push on. They enter the dead city. No one knows when it was or where it was, not even all. The city is made of a dry white stone, like chalk, but not chalk. Its surfaces are beginning to turn to powder at the merest touch. Age does that. The sky over the towering city is the blue side of violet, and there are 8 bright stars dotted in it. When the wind lifts, as it does now and again, sighs of white dust trail from the sills and corners of the white walls like vapour, a city slowly being erased. It is an empty place of white buildings with empty doorways. There is no furniture, no sign of decoration or possessions, no sign of the long dead. All thinks that whatever used to be in these buildings has long since resolved into dust, along with the inhabitants. Only the silent towers remain, the chambers, the vacant stairways. After walking for an hour or two, they realize 2 things. One is that the city has no limits. As they move past towers and walls and rooftops, they sight further towers and walls and rooftops beyond. The second thing is that the emptiness is unnerving. They feel anxious, though there is no sound except their footsteps and the sigh of the wind, and no movement except the faint streamers of white dust peeling off the edges of walls and doorways. When they speak to each other, their voices echo from the surrounding streets, but not immediately. Each echo takes a few minutes to return, just a little too long for it to feel comfortable or natural, and each echo returns as a perfect facsimile of the original words, not a sound hollowed by acoustics. For this reason, they quickly stop speaking. All stops and checks his compass. They have found another cutting place, and by no means too soon. As he takes out the athame and prepares to make the incision, an echo comes to them along the dead white streets. The echo is a word, and the word is Makar. None of them had spoken. The humidity on the far side is intense. They feel it coming through the slit before they step across. Beads of sweat immediately manifest on their pale skins, gleaming like diamonds. A rainforest awaits them. It has been waiting forever. It is an endless jade twilight of waterlogged glades, and they are knee-deep in bright green murk. Graft struggles to maintain traction and stability. Sunlight sparkles and shafts down through the canopy. Moss as thick as emerald velvet coats the tree trunks and half-sunken logs. There is a throat-tightening smell of rot. Winged insects, each one looking like a watchmaker's intricate masterpiece, whir past them, hover, and then speed on. It is another place that all does not know. He wonders if this is a sign that their route is less guided now, more random. Or is it a sign that it's becoming all the more concealed? Which forsaken outworld is this? What rimworld hell? His sweating palms shift the rifle nervously. The rainforest is a bad place for a fight. He has never liked jungle warfare. They keep stopping to help Graft free himself, sometimes having to lever him out of the ooze with blackened lengths of log.
I don't like this, Crank remarks.
It is matter of fact. All wonders if the young soldier means the physical discomfort of the wet heat and the toil, or simply the location. The attitude applies convincingly to both. Then the place falls silent. It is a chilling thing. Until the silence, they had not realized the rainforest was so full of noises, the buzz of insects, the splash of water, the crack of undergrowth, the chirp of amphibians, the whistle of birds. Only when it stops, when it all stops at a stroke, do they recognize it by its distressing absence. They all freeze, listening, willing sounds to return. Oll holds up a hand and turns slowly, training his rifle. His movement makes the very slightest sloshing sound in the water around his shins. Something rushes them from the stand of trees behind them. It is man-sized and man-shaped, though its legs are proportionally shorter and its arms proportionally longer than human standard. It is an ape thing, scrawny and lean. It has no eyes. Its head is entirely a gaping mouth of carnivore teeth, lips pulled back. It shrieks as it charges, water sprays, cat screams. It bounds over a half-sunken log, leaping, clawing paws outstretched. Oll fires. Three shots smack into its torso and bowl it backwards into the green soup with a clumsy, slapping splash. Thrashing, it sinks.
"What in the name of..."
Zybe starts to say, but there is not time. There is another ape thing charging them, and another, and then a fourth. They come, pounding out of the topaz gloom, shrieking, unmindful of the fate that greeted the first of them.
"Rapid fire!"
Oll commands, shooting. Multiple targets. He cannot take them all. He needs the others. Crank is fumbling with his rifle, his frantic hands caught in the strap. Bale fires, winging one of the creatures enough to slow it, and then aims to kill it. Zybes misses everything, including tree trunks. Oll has shot two more, both clean kills, but other ape things are appearing. A half dozen, a dozen, all bounding and charging. Only he and Bale hit anything. The shrieking wounded drop hard into the murk, but others take their place. Their teeth are yellow bone, their maws red. One gets so close that Oll barely gets his shot in. Crank has finally lined up. His firing is messy, but he adds to the stopping power, dropping one, and then a second. Cat has taken out her pistol. Bracing it with two hands, she shoots alongside them and makes hits. She understands the extremity of the situation. She winces every time the creatures shriek. Zybes makes a kill, but it is a rare success. He is simply not a natural marksman. One of the ape things gets too close to him, past his ability to hit it, and reaches out to tear his throat out. Graft grabs it by the neck with a manipulator arm, lifting and hurling it away into the trees like a straw doll. Oll shoots and brings down the last of the ape things. No more come. Silence falls again, apart from their rasping breaths and the tap of falling leaves and bark fragments. Then the noise of the rainforest resumes as if it had never gone away. Oll breathes out a long breath and wipes the sweat from his brow. He has finally realized where they are. When? Some kind of intuition has informed him, some kind of deep-time memory. This is Terra, before the rise of man. The things that attacked them are things that might one day evolve into men. Except these corpses floating face down in the green soup, show how early the taint of the warp touched man's homeworld. Oll does not speak to his companions about any of this.
"Push on," he tells them instead.
The compass stops working. The pendulum hangs heavy and refuses to swing.
"We're lost," says Crank, watching Oll's work. "The word is becalmed," Oll snaps. But it does not matter what the word is. He has never attempted this kind of journey before, so he does not know if the problem with the compass is to be expected or not. Nothing he has ever been told or taught about the art of travelling this way has prepared him for the idea that the compass might stop working. He tries to cover his tension. He tries to reassure himself with his own analogy. Becalmed. At sea, sometimes, the winds drop away and all is still, and then there is nothing anyone can do and nowhere to go until the wind comes back. That is all. That is all that's happening. The winds of the Empyrean have simply eased off for a moment, their breath spent. All is still. They will pick back up soon as you like. They will pick back up, and the pilgrims will be on their way again.
"Everything's okay," Oll tells them. "Everything's going to be okay." They are in some autumnal place. The sky is dark, like smudged charcoal, and the distant hills loom, brown with gorse and sedge. Black birds circle in the distance. The surrounding thornwood, bared of leaves, is an endless thicket of spikes and claws, an organic cage. The thorns and twigs are all pale and cold, like bone. Small birds or insects have speared red berries on some thorn spikes so they can be gnawed and pecked at. The juice drips like blood. Oll keeps working at the chart and compass, rattling the rose in its little silver skull box, rubbing the pendulum weight between his palms, as though communicating body heat may somehow activate it. They remain dead, inert. The others move away from him in different directions, scouting the area. Everything is quiet, apart from the sporadic chatter of birds. What if we've made a wrong cut? He wonders. What if they've stepped off the wind routes and now cannot find their way back? What if he made an incision in error, and they are marooned on God knows where in God knows when? How can any place in the cosmos, not be touched by the Empyrean winds? The analogy suddenly seems so banal. Even when the winds have dropped and the ship is becalmed, a compass will still spin towards magnetic north, and if there is no wind, a man puts his back into it and rows. He rows, like a bastard, to the beat of the stroke drum. He had learned that on the voyage to Colchis. That was when Colchis was still a kingdom on the Black Sea, not the homeworld of the treacherous 17th. "We're going to have to row," Oll says out loud, but the others have moved too far away to hear. He gets up, looking for them, and sees their shadows moving through the thornwood. "Come back!" he calls. Someone answers him, but he cannot make out the words. Damn them. They're being stupid. It is not safe. Oll knows that with certainty. He knows it suddenly as the tingle of cold at the base of his spine. That is not just the cool woodland air chilling the sweat there. It is a hint, a sign, like the way the root of his tongue used to itch before a big fight, or his hands used to tremble when someone was going to die. He felt none of those things on Calf, because Calf had happened so suddenly. The doom came masked until the very last moment by the darkest treachery. But here, wherever here is, doom is not coming suddenly. It is stalking them. It is drawing close, a relentless predator tracking them, keeping steady, keeping low, just beyond the line of sight. He knows the predator's name, and it is not a human name. Makar. It is a thing sent to end them, a thing sent to take back the blade, a thing sent by the malicious deities of the warp to ensure that their plans would not be upset. Oll feels he ought to be flattered. He is a perpetual, and such beings are far from common. Nevertheless, they are insignificant in the universal pattern. Perpetuals do not upset the plans of the warped ones. A renegade perpetual on the run with a handful of humans, that is hardly a threat against schemes that encompass light centuries of space and epochs of the universe. Yet Makar has been sent. Flattered? That is what he ought to feel. Oll hefts his las rifle, getting it set, as though a las rifle will be of any assistance when the time comes. He wonders how far off the predator is. A cut or two away, or already in this world, out there in the sedge beyond the thornwood. What was it John said? It's needed for another task, too, so it can't keep looking for you forever. It has a destiny of its own. Typical gnomic grammaticus. But the basic advice is sound. Go the long way round. Stay low. Keep out of sight. You cannot fight it, so wait for it to run out of time and give up. Yes. Sound advice. The trouble is, Oll knows too well that it has already got their scent. Makar is tracking them. It will be a demon thing with a non-human name like that. How is it tracking them? The life glow of the dagger? It is not as if Oll's a Sykana lighting the way. Oll's never had the sight, or any of the other gifts that the perpetuals often have. No sight, no mind gloss, no telekine or pyrokine. All he has are the ticks and twinges, the chill on his back, the itch in his tongue, the hand tremble. His left eyelid used to flutter when there was a Sykana nearby. It used to happen all the time when he was near Medea on that ship. That is why he knew before Jason that the Colchis witch had real gifts and was not the usual brand of yowling, histrionic soothsayer. As if on cue, All's left eyelid twitches. He freezes. Hands tight on the gun, he waits for the stink of the warp, waits for Makar, whatever form Makar takes, to erupt through the thornwood and finish them. He waits for Makar to finish them and make this place their communal grave, unmourned and unmarked. The dusk continues to close, however, and the birds continue to circle. He turns. The others are still wandering around, exploring. But Cat is right beside him. She came back when he called. His eyelid flutters. "Oh, God," he murmurs. It is not just her dark eyes that remind him of the witch he knew all those centuries ago. He understands why she is quiet and reserved, a loner, an outsider. He understands why she came to do piecework on his farm, like a runaway looking for work in return for lodging. He understands where her knowing questions come from. He's pretty sure that even she does not know what she is, that she has never been assessed, never been recruited by the black ships. She is a latent, touched just enough to give her a life of sorrow and trouble, a life of not fitting in, a life of depression and of not being understood. She is touched just enough to make her shine like a little lamp in the night. "What's the matter?" she asks him. "Are we okay?" She smiles at her clever use of the unfamiliar word. "We need to find shelter," he says. "There's a darkness coming on." He wonders, seriously wonders, if he should kill her. Then he wonders at himself for even thinking it. "Makar," she says.
"What?"
"That word. The echo in that city." Cat looks at him with Medea's big dark eyes. "Ever since I heard it, I haven't been able to forget it, as if the word is poison, filling my mind up."
All lowers his rifle and touches the wrapped athame at his waist. That is what it wants. That is what they're not allowed to have. That is what they must not deliver. Something occurs to him. They do have a weapon. If the athame is so powerful, if it is so precious that the warped one sent a demon to recover it, then it is a serious damn thing. A serious, serious damn thing. It cuts a path through the warped universe. What else might it cut? The thought gives him a glimmer of hope, and Cat at his side feels that hope and smiles at it without even realizing why she's doing it. Then the hope goes. The root of his tongue itches suddenly. His hands tremble. There is going to be a battle. A battle and a death. What sun there was has gone. The sky is full of banked grey clouds running in the wind, and the breeze makes the thorn cages around them creak and rattle. They feel the wind on their faces, but there is still no wind to stir All's compass. "We can't move from here," All tells his accidental pilgrims. "We can't go back or forwards. We have to stay here, and that means we might have to make our stand here."
"Our stand?" asks Ibes. "This is no place for a fight," says Bale Rain. The boy has not seen much war, only been schooled in it, but he is not stupid. A ragged tract of hillside scrub, thickly wooded by autumn thorn and bounded by gorse, it is no place for a fight indeed. If they had an hour, they could trek up the hill to the ring of standing stones, maybe dig in up there. They do not have an hour. All's tongue tells him that. So does his eyelid and his hands and the cold sweat on his back. So does the look in Cat's eyes.
"Where do we find cover?"
Crank asks, swallowing hard. He flicks a hand at the nearest branch of brittle, dry thorn.
This stuff? This won't stop Lazrounds. There's no shelter. Do we entrench or..."
"Shh," says All.
"Where do we find cover?"
Crank insists.
"It won't be Laz fire," says All.
"What will it be?"
asks Ibes.
"Makar," says Cat, unable not to.
"What does she mean?"
asks Crank, hysteria in his voice.
"Stay calm," All tells him.
He tells them all, "A bad thing is coming our way. We've given it the slip so far, but it's found us at last."
"What bad thing?" Crank asks.
"Something from Calf," murmurs Bale, understanding. "One of those things that came to Calf, or one that was on its way.
All nods. Crank screws up his face, lets out a squeaking moan, and starts to cry.
How did it find us? Bale asks.
All cannot help looking at Cat.
We just got unlucky, he replies. We did well for a long time, but we got unlucky. So now we make the best of things.
Where do we find cover from a thing like that?
Crank wails. All taps his chest.
In here, he says. Back in the days of faith, that's how we kept the demons out. Belief, strength, fortitude.
All the pious,
laughs Zibes without humour.
Piety is a virtue,
All nods. I've always had faith, right from the moment of the anointing of my newborn head in Nineveh. Always had it, always kept it, even when all the churches were swept away. Swept away for being anachronistic. I believe in a higher power, and that's what we're facing now. Another power, anyway. Higher, lower, other. Not a human thing, not a mortal thing.
You're not mortal, says Cat.
But I'm human. This is God and demon stuff, and in the midst of that, faith is all you can hold on to. I've always had faith. That's why he never liked me, and never brought me into the trusted circle.
Who?
Asks Bale. All shakes his head.
Doesn't matter. I've always kept faith, and I've never tried to push it on anyone, never evangelized. Well, not for a long time anyway. So I'm not asking you to do anything strange.
He thumps his trembling hand against his heart again.
Just believe. Believe in whatever you like. Believe in the Emperor, or in yourself, or in whatever light you see in your dreams, or the solidity of the ground beneath your feet. Believe in me, for all I care. Just believe.
We have to do something else, Trooper Person, says Graft. I cannot believe. There has to be purpose. There has to be activity.
He's right, says Bale.
Okay, says All.
Okay, then, we sing.
We sing?
Crank splutters.
Yeah, we sing together. Strengthens the mind. I'll teach you a song.
A hymn.
In the old days, the faithful sang together to keep the spirits up and keep the demons and the darkness out. We'll do that.
He teaches them the words. Just a verse or two. O Lord and Master of mankind. They start to sing, reluctantly. They fumble the words, forget a few, mangle the tune. Graft cannot hold anything but the one drone note. All keeps going at it over and over, repeat and repeat, checking over his shoulder all the while, checking the tingle in his hands and the twitch of his eyelid. That is all hymns and prayers were back in the day when real demons walked the earth. They were utterances of protection, articulations of defiance. They joined people in the act of singing, joined their strengths, their beliefs. They made faith a weapon, if only a passive weapon, a shield at least, or indeed at most. Even for those who did not believe, like All did, there were other benefits. Joined in singing, people were joined in activity. They were reminded that they were not alone. They were connected and bolstered. It gave them something to do, something to focus their minds on instead of fear. Last thing All needed was anyone panicking. And sometimes singing is just noise, and it protects, like Orpheus protected them.
Keep going, All says. Keep singing, get to the end and start again. Keep singing.
He turns and goes to the edge of the thorn thicket. Behind him, they're singing as loud as they can. He scans the brown sedge and the hollows of the land that are already shaded with night. How many thousand battlefields has he surveyed this way, watching for the enemy to show himself? The land here reminds him of the moors beyond the wall when he was patrolling the parapets, watching for the painted men. It reminds him of the rolling grasses of the Old Tai, watching for the approach of the Sarmatian riders. It reminds him... His hands tremble. Makar is not down there at all. Makar is here. Right to the edge of the thorn cage, looking in. The thorns catch fire. A stretch of the thorn brush, 3 or 4 meters broad, bursts into bright orange flame, burns up like paper, and spills into ash, leaving a gap big enough to drive a transport through. All backs up, his hands trembling on the grip of his rifle. It is dark out here beyond the gap in the white thorn wall, as though a piece of midnight has arrived early. But there are eyes in it. He saw them looking in, ancient eyes for an ancient feral mind, yellow slits with black slash irises, glaring eyes, evil eyes, eyes that stared forever from the prow of a ship, cursed eyes that means the end of everything. All backs away. He ignores the twitch and the itch and the tremble. He ignores the lump in his swallow and the tears in his eyes. In his long lives, he has seen plenty. He has never seen anything like this, though. The demon enters the thornwood through the gap it has burned in the thicket. It bubbles in, like fluid, spilling over the boundary and collecting in the clumped soil. It is like tar. It smokes in the darkness. All can see is the spreading wet stain of it on the ground, growing like a shadow. There is a bulk of it above, a monstrous monolithic shape, a slice of darkness cut from pure night, super heavy like spent plutonium. Above the eyes loom the impression of horns, wider than an aircraft's wings. He smells it. He retches. In the seeping black pools around its feet, spider-leg stalks and spastic pseudopods sprout and fade, jutting briefly from the steaming tar and dying back like a time-lapse picked feed of nocturnal weeds. It is a shadow, straining to exist. Voices chirp and snigger. All hears the voices of people he knows on the wind and realizes they are lies. He hears the voices of people he has not seen alive in 30,000 years. Lies. Lies. He hears John's laugh. He hears Pascal at Verdun asking for a light. He hears Gaius on the wall, cursing the rain and praising the virtues of Galician girls. He hears Commander Vallis whisper the name of a forgotten god as they both flinch from a nuclear light blooming across the Pan-Pacific horizon. He hears a man question the quality of bronze stirrups in strongly accented Scythian. He hears Zaid Rahim, pinned in his burning T-62, begging to die. He hears the shock troopers around him moan as the officer tells them that their objective will be the Brummen Hives. He hears Jason and Orpheus singing together. He hears Lieutenant Winslow dictating his will the night before Copenhagen. He hears Private Labella whistling as she fries beans and eggs the morning after the social basin fell. He hears his son, 5 days old, crying lustily in his crib the day that the Norsemen landed. As if he knew, 5 days old, and knew what was coming. All raises his rifle, slips the toggle to full auto, and fires. The advancing darkness ripples as his streaming shots strike it. The darkness absorbs the bright bolts, but spatters too, each wound squirting fluid like milk. The wounds vanish as fast as he makes them. The lactic blood fades. He cannot hurt it. It knows it, and he knows it. It does not just want him dead. It wants him broken. It wants his soul burned out with misery before it consumes him. It wants to anger him, wants him to feel rage and pain and frustration and all the other human inadequacies of a 35,000-year-long life. It knows he is a perpetual. All realizes that suddenly, despite the pain robbing him of sense. He is caught up in the death of his son, a loss that took him 3 centuries to come to terms with, a loss he had pushed to the back of his overstuffed mind, a loss Makar has gone straight for. But even so, all realizes. It knows he is a perpetual. They would all be dead already otherwise. It doesn't get to do this very often. It doesn't get to torment a being with such a great capacity for torment. All is a treat, a delicacy. All those heartless centuries of pain and loss and disappointment to tease out and relive, so many, many more than a human life can encompass. The pain is going to kill me, All thinks. The very thought of me is going to kill me. To remember all I've ever been through will kill me stone dead. It will not be quick. He stops shooting. His anger is as spent as his power cell. He throws his rifle aside. He turns his back on Makar and walks away. He walks back to the others. They are still trying to sing, but it is not working. Keep going, he urges, his voice breaking. Keep going.
Forgive our foolish ways. Come on, don't listen to it, drown it out. Don't listen to its lies.
He hears an old friend in a Dresden shop chatting as he packs china in newspaper.
In case the planes come tonight.
He hears his sisters calling his name from the cages on the caravan. He hears him, the day they met, recognizing a kindred being.
The likes of us, he says to all, the likes of us will leave our print on things down the ages. That is why we were made the way we were. The courses of our lives will not go unmarked.
Mine will, all assures him. I have no stomach for the games you want to play with the world. I just want an ordinary life.
My dear friend, you'll have as many of those as you want.
It was summer, a meadow beyond the walls of Nineveh. He had never met another perpetual before. He would never meet another like him. Look at him now, after all this time having turned his back on all those games and never being a part of any of them. Look at foolish old All Person, crossing the universe on a knife blade for his sake, running a fool's errand through the warp and weft of the cosmos to stop his games from unravelling. Makar comes closer, gurgling laughter in the darkness. The voices swirl around him like blossom, the voices of All's life. The pain, the lies. All and his pilgrims are in a circle, their backs facing outwards. All's back is directly to the darkness.
Don't look, he says. Don't listen. Sing up. Drown it out.
They have stopped singing, though. They just look at each other. Bale Rain is to All's right, Cat to his left. All places a hand on each of their shoulders.
Don't look, he says.
It's going to be okay.
It is not, but what else is he supposed to say? The voices are in his ears. The pain of his life is unimaginable. He knows the others are hearing their own voices too. Bale can hear Neve. Zybes is begging his mother to stop calling out. Crank is crying about someone called Pappy. Cat is just shuddering. All does not want to know what she is hearing. He takes his hand off her shoulder slowly. If there is a chance at all, it is coming, and it is going to be minuscule.
Makar!
She barks, an involuntary sound. Shh! He soothes her through his tears.
Makar!
She blurts.
Easy,
he says. He lowers his hand to his waist, to his belt, to the wrapped athame. He can feel the demon's breath on the nape of his neck. The athame is warm, too. One chance. One tiny chance.
Malak!
Cat squeals, eyes rolling back.
Hush now, All says, taking hold of the dagger.
Malak! Malak! Malak!
She screams. Meaningless. He has lost her. She is gone.
Malakartho!
She cries and vomits.
Malakartho! Makartho! Makar!
He has the dagger. One chance. He wheels around, blade raised. The thing is gone. Only ordinary darkness surrounds them. The smell of it has gone, and the heat of it. The tar has vanished. Only the voices remain, just for a minute or so, receding into the distance like whisperers moving away into a room beyond. All blinks. He realizes his mouth is open to scream, so he closes it. He feels sweat on his flushed face. He lowers the blade.
I don't,
he starts to say. He looks at the others. Bale is nursing the sobbing Crank. Zybes is sitting on the ground with his head in his hands. Graft has picked Cat up. She is limp.
Oh, God. No.
She is not dead, though. There is vomit down the front of her clothes and blood streaming from her nose.
It went back,
she murmurs, looking up at All.
Back?
Didn't you feel it? It was pulled back. It was yanked away from us, from here. It was needed somewhere else. For something more important than us.
All shakes his head.
He remembers John's words. Keep away from it for long enough. It will eventually have to give up and turn back.
What in God's name?
All wonders out loud.
Malloch Cartho, Cat says.
Craft helps her to stand up. She's not steady. That's not a human name, All says.
No, it is, she insists. I feel it is. A transhuman name, at least. Whoever Malloch Cartho is, Malloch Cartho is why Makar had to go and leave us.
Then I pity poor Malloch Cartho, says All. Cat shakes her head.
I don't know why, but I don't think you should.
It has a destiny of its own. Dawn breaks soft over the thornwood. The winds rise with it, rustling. All takes a bearing. He is pretty sure that the approach of Makar was shielding them from the winds and prevented them getting a bearing. The skies are clear, for now at least. They've still got a long, long way to go, and it's not going to get easier.
What do we do? Asks Ibes.
Do we keep going?
Adds Crank.
Do we have a route? A direction?
Boreas, All tells them, putting the compass and chart away.
The north-northeasterly, Boreas, or Mise, to the Greekans at least.
Nord-Ostroni, to the Franks. To the Romani, Aquilo. He takes out the dagger and prepares to make the next cut. Their voyage will continue as it has been, like their lives and their destinies, unmarked. That is why they might succeed.
So what do we do? Asks Bale.
All puts his hand flat against the air and starts to cut.
We push on, he says. Okay.